his growth at a very early age. You know, I was born in 1982. So I would say that myself and my peers, maybe people 5 years younger, tops, we are like the last vestige of a long tradition of passive comic book consumers, people who were able to just grab a hold of some comics by going to the grocery store with your mom and visiting like maybe one of the 5 spinner racks full of comics, and sort of got into the whole thing that way. There was a social aspect to comic books as a kid because they were less of a boutique item and there wasn't much of a barrier to entry to grab them. Kids in school had them too. So I had maybe 2 or 3 other friends who were interested in comics, and we all took a particular oath to kind of starve through the week and not get school lunch and kind of save that dollar we would pay for our school lunch. Each day, at the end of the week, we would have $5. And if you look at the price tag on these, which are the oldest comics that I have that I got as a kid that are still kind of intact, these comics are $1. You could get almost 5 comics each Friday. An interesting thing about these comics, on the very first page, you would see a little credit box that called out the people who put that particular issue together. So they're a writer, penciler, inker, colorist. So I knew that a human hand was behind this material, and that was immediately interesting to me. For some reason, I always thought that everybody just knew what they were going to be in some predestined fashion our entire lives. So I imagine when I was a kid, like the little narc home monitor kid, like he's going to grow up and become a cop, and she's smart, so she'll be a doctor or a lawyer. And I had that ridiculous thought for years and years, probably way too long, especially when I started to figure out the different kinds of jobs that were out there. So I got creeped out at like the idea of a proctologist. Stare at kids in my class, just trying to figure out like which one of these creeps is just shivering to look inside somebody's butthole for the same burn and excitement that I have about comics. I only recently got over that, by the way. So, I sort of embarked on this journey to become a cartoonist and try to figure out like how will I even accomplish that. The best that I could come up with would be to just crib the stories that I responded to the most and draw analog characters in play. Because I would not, like, for instance, this is a comic drawn by a really cool artist named Michael Golden. And I wouldn't be able to approximate his artwork by copying it at this stage. So I just supplied my own characters and completely ripped the stories because, I was more interested in doing the penciling thing than writing. That was bourgeois or something. Eventually, that did start to get a little bit old to me. So I graduated to writing and drawing my own comics with existing characters. And I'm actually like very proud of this one because I don't toot my own horn very much, but I gave Professor X some metal legs, which just seems perfectly reasonable. And if Juggernaut is going to smash through your palatial estate and come after you, like you might not want to be in a wheelchair. It's just another page from those ridiculous notebook comics that I had. And just to sort of get away from like what you're saying right now, maybe 10 years ago there was this documentary called Scratch about the history of DJing, and they all, maybe 5 or 6 of those guys, shared this moment where all across the country at the exact same time, on the exact same day, on the exact same hour, they were in their homes watching the Grammys, and Herbie Hancock was on the Grammys performing his song Rocket, and when the program was on, it would cut to this guy in the back, Grandmixer DXC, who's scratching records. And from that point forward, all of these men cite that moment as being the moment that they decided that they wanted to really become DJs. And I thought that was a really powerful thing that they were spread out that way. And this movie here, Comic Book Confidential, sort of shares a similar, so like a similar sort of thing with that movie, in that you know, this informed all of my major influences moving forward from this point. This was on just very randomly. I'm flicking through the stations, and you know, you see Spider-Man on the screen, and it's weird. So I went back and watched this whole documentary. It was on A&E, and you know, like I said, it informed all of my influences from this point forward. So guys like Charles Burns, Jaime Hernandez, Robert Crumb. If you look on the bottom there, a unit sort of described who I was and mentioned that I worked for Harvey Pekar, and Harvey Pekar had a much revered excerpt on this documentary. And just going to conventions and things, I met maybe two or three cartoonists who shared that exact moment with me, where they were just young cartoonists, well, you know, one of these, and they were flipping through the stations and they saw this movie too. One of the things that was most inspiring about the flick was the Robert Crumb interview, where they just flash an excerpt from when he was a young teenager doing comics in his notebooks as well. So I had no idea really how to start, but I saw that this Robert Crumb guy, who's, you know, big and popular and famous, started drawing comics in notebooks, and you know, it made me feel like I was on the right track, so to speak. So that really spoke to me, and I really started to research him more and try to seek out his material, just because I felt a kind of a kinship just from that single image of, it's kind of hard to tell, but that's on a piece of notebook paper. Immediately, you know, went to my mom, we have to go to the library. Like, this documentary opened my entire world up to what comics are. It's not just Spider-Man, not just the stuff that you can get at the grocery store, but there's a whole landscape that I have no knowledge about, but I'm extremely curious. And I found this book, Comics, by Les Daniels. It's little known, particularly because I don't know that the writing is so great. I've tried to reread it a couple of times. It's not that awesome, but it's each chapter highlights a specific era in comics throughout the history. So the Golden Age stuff, from Superman and Batman to the 1950s, the EC horror comics and the furry animal comics. The Marvel Age comics with Fantastic Four, things like that, and then there was an entire section in the back of the book talking about underground comics. With each chapter, at the end, there would be complete stories highlighting material that was covered within said chapter. So there would be complete Superman stories by Siegel and Shuster, and EC horror stories, and Harvey Kurtzman and war comics, and a copious amount of underground material that I just clamor to at age 8, you know, with all this full frontal leg spread weirdo kind of material that really spoke to me. You know, very important, two very important influences that sort of put me on the path to understand that comics are more than just what you get at the grocery store. So I started to just dig further and further and just grab the weirdest stuff that's the most anti Spider-Man and X-Men comics I could find. And you know, the 80s, admittedly, for a kid growing up, was a simpler time. Like, if you were into video games and you had Atari and you wanted to play a football game, you would go to the store and buy a game called football or tennis or boxing. And I decided that I was into ninjas, so I grabbed this comic, Ninja, which 90% of the stuff that I picked up is pretty much garbage. You got this impression that the artists who were in these books were just not good enough to draw Spider-Man, or you know, it made it to the big leagues, and it all stunk from that in a way. But this comic in particular, the reason I highlighted it was because the back cover was extremely interesting to me. I drew and redrew these characters, immediately captivated by it. In the bottom left corner, you see Gillespie. So this guy, Stosh Gillespie, he must be the guy who painted this. And I would endlessly draw these characters and just fantasize about what a day in the life of the Ugly family must have been like. Couldn't find this material anywhere. But I was this incredible fan of Stosh Gillespie. And throughout the years, little did I know that Stash Gillespie is a pen name for one of the best working cartoonists in America today, Dan Klaus, who has drawn this comic book 8-Ball throughout most of the 90s, and is best known for his comic Ghost World, which was turned into a movie. And throughout my entire creative development, I certainly have stolen plenty from Dan Klaus cartooning, as we'll get into. A really important comic that sort of put me on the path of, you know, deeper intellectualizing of the medium was this Quantum Fear comic that I grabbed at the height of the Tales from the Crypt being on television. And I don't know if you've seen that show. Some of you were pretty young. Each show is very formulaic, and it would, you know, somebody would enact a crime, probably kill somebody. At the end of the story, they would meet their demise in a similar fashion with a cherry on top. And I knew that going into reading this, but there was one particular story that just blew my mind, because I was more schooled in comics in general, and every comic you would buy, it would sort of start at the middle of the story, and at the end there would be the bait and switch cliffhanger, which when you come back next week, you know, there would be some sort of deus ex machina way that they got out of the cliffhanger, it would tell a little bit more story, and then cliffhanger again. And this one story, it was the tale of this wife beater who is a vicious man, and he beats his wife and he kills somebody. And, you know, it's just like a typical Wednesday. He comes home, he beats his wife and goes to sleep, wakes up in his torture rack, bound, but just being stretched out. And I went the next month just excited to see how the story was going to end. I needed to see how this guy was going to get out of it, or the cops going to come, put him in cuffs, take him away, and put the woman in some sort of psychological institution or something. But they didn't even speak about it in the next issue, and it made me realize, whoa, this guy died. Crazy. So my friend Marcel Walker, he's right here somewhere, and he taught a cartooning class at Pittsburgh Center for the Arts when I was in middle school. And one of the best classes that I had was a comic book production class that he put together. And the idea of the whole course was to give you maybe 9 weeks to work on your own 4 or 5 page comic. And at the end of that, everybody's story was going to be bound in one volume, and we were each going to get 10 copies of our comic. And I say this experience as being the moment I got addicted to the idea of print, and the idea that, okay, there's 15 people in this course, there's 150 copies of my comic in the wild. It immediately captured my imagination and you know, furthered my interest. And you can see this cover for our first issue, I just cribbed from the format of that horror comic that I was into. And also, before Mad was a magazine, it was a comic. And every so often, there would be these summer specials that would contain just a reprint of one of the old Mad comics from the 50s. And this is the cover of Mad number 20. So for the second issue of our class, I had to crib that cover just because I thought it was super subversive and cool. Like, yeah, man, sneak that in the class. This is a cover to the third one. I just included it because I remember thinking I was such a genius cutting up my mom's Cosmopolitan magazine and you know, substituting my own character for it's so odd. But the date on this is 1996, and the very next image of mine that I show you is from 99, and it's sort of remarkable when I put this thing in order to just see the rapid progression of. You know, not tooting my horn, but just like at a young age, there was like this huge growth spurt in creatively for me. But in all the comics I was checking out in the mid-90s, there would be these ads with this Gabriel Brothers version of Tarzan that was in every comic, and it was like white noise because it was everywhere. And you know, upon further investigation, I realized this is an entire school for comic book making, and teaches you the ins and outs of that whole game. Like, this isn't X-ray specs. This isn't a book that you pay $5 and get some kind of pamphlet that teaches you how to draw. Like, this is a whole class. And so I lowered my sort of goal bar at this point, and my interest for the rest of high school was simply to become good enough to go here, because I would read all of these interviews with people with, you know, former alumni who describe the course as being highly exclusive. So many people want to get in there, and they turn people away. If you miss one homework assignment, they boot you out. And you know, my parents very supportive, and they never said, "You ain't going to comic book school." But ultimately, I kind of wish they did, because like as much as I wanted to go there, kind of embarrasses me to talk about it. But it's a part of my story, so I have to talk about it a little bit. And like the main problem was just because I went there in 2000, and that was right around the paradigm shift of the analog to digital convergence in print media, where, you know, there was an old way of doing things where you would send your artwork, and they would have, like, if you wanted to spot color, you would have these overlays, and then they would shoot these things with cameras and all this nonsense. And but they moved from that to just, you know, send us your TIFF, your high-res TIFF file, blah, blah, blah. And at the school, they were teaching that analog way of doing things for the first couple of years. And, you know, when you hit the third year, you got the pleasure and opportunity to learn how to use Adobe Photoshop. So just being pragmatic, and, you know, I've never been in anybody's debt in my entire life. I never borrowed $5 from anybody. So I realized I had these school loans I was going to have to pay, and I was just not interested in, you know, dropping $30,000 for the privilege to learn how to use Photoshop. Like, that wasn't a part of my world at all. So went there for a year, learned what I learned. I got some valuable stuff out of it, but ultimately, like, went on my own. And this is some imagery from my portfolio that in high school I was just working up to try to be a part of, to try to be good enough to get into the Kubert School. And this image is from 99, so like, if there's that one from 96, 99, I started to figure out how to use perspective and things like that. The reason I include this is just because it sort of showcases my interest in hip-hop to a certain extent. The story, it's rather crude, but it's about, you know, it's just a graffiti artist running around, you know, spray painting murals and stuff. And I was a very frustrated cartoonist because I realized I wasn't good enough to get into comics at the time. So, you know, I definitely confess with my homeboy HB, who's up there, to painting the town red around here. Another thing that, while researching the school, that I was interested in was the fact that a lot of these guys, they broke into comics as being letterers, just the guys who write the dialogue bubbles that Spider-Man says. And the school is called the Kubert School, and his sons, Adam and Andy, they broke into the comic book biz. I didn't know what nepotism was, by the way. They broke into the comic book biz at age 11 as comic book letterers. So I was, you know, maybe 13 or 14 at the time. There was no way I'm going to let an 11-year-old show me up with, you know, his comic book sans scroll or whatever. So I just found these earlier in the week. I would buy tablets of graph paper and just write these like free associated things in a comic book font. And I realized, like, you know, I had maybe 5 or 6 tablets of that, and then I learned how to use the Ames Guide, which is what cartoonists use to put the words down, and I had these full, like, ledger pages like this, just full of this writing. And, you know, if I would have gotten hit by a bus or something, and my parents found that stuff, like, they might really just get the wrong impression. For sure. So I get out of the Kubert School, and I'm just working some bullcrap call center in West Mifflin to pay down that debt. I started getting those AES or AEG bills or whatever it's called, and just, you know, felt so indebted and wanted to get in the black before, you know, as soon as I could, so that I could start my life. To pay all that stuff down, every chance I got, and, you know, I would draw my own comics in the meantime. And the comics biz in early 2000, 2001 was probably even a little bit better than it is now in terms of getting your work out there. There were maybe 4 or 5 publishers who had anthologies that they would publish work by up-and-coming cartoonists or just people who were new on the scene. So there were 4 or 5 opportunities to get published. I would do these strips and send the work to those venues and just, you know, start amassing rejection letters, which it didn't bug me because I really didn't feel I was good enough at that point anyhow, but it was like, why not just take a chance? But I didn't want those comics to be dead on the vine. It felt like too much work to put them all together and send it to four guys who two say no. So what I started to do was I sought out every cartoonist that I had interest in, who I respected, people whose work I responded to, started to just do every kind of search I could. I would buy comics and look in the back and get their snail mail information, because this is, you know, before MySpace. Like, everybody's so accessible at this point. But you know, you had to really do some research and work to find, you know, find a way to correspond with these people. And Harvey Peacock is one of the men who I respected as you know, from that Comic Book Confidential documentary. And if you take a look at this comic here in the bottom left, his P.O. Box information is sort of photoshopped on there to approximate the subscription information of like a Time magazine or something like that. I didn't know that that was his real P.O. Box, but I was sending my comics there all the time, and they weren't coming back, so I just imagined they're going somewhere. And the American Splendor movie comes out. My friend at HB and I, we go check it out. You know, it was a tough sale. We had to drag whichever girls we were hanging with at the time to sort of endure the flick with us. And at the end of the movie, for days, we were just talking in an Harvey Peacock voice, because he has a very gravelly, gruff kind of voice. In fact, before the American Splendor movie, it was a stage play. And the guy who played Harvey Peacock in the stage play was this man, Dan Castellaneta, who you might know is the voice of Homer Simpson. And I have it on very good word that the stage version of Harvey Peacock sounded a lot like Krusty the Clown. eventually, 10 days after the movie, at a point where my guard was sufficiently down, I get a call from Harvey Peacock, and you know, my friendship with HB is it's steeped in respect, and we're not frat boys about the way we hang out. We don't pull pranks on each other and call each other big bitch and stuff like that. So I'm on the phone, HB, why are you fucking with me, man? And I don't remember what Peacock did or said to sort of let me know that, you know, it was really the guy. But after the phone conversation, I received, you know, he gave me word that, you know, I'm a cartoonist now. Like, he's going to give me some work. It took a year to manifest, but my first major, like, published work was in this Our Movie Year comic. And this is a four-page strip that he gave me that I really just broke my neck on. And I could say that this was absolutely as good as I could draw at the time. You know, it's full of flaws and everything like that, but I really did my best. And at the end of that process, you know, it was done. I did a four-pager, and that was probably all I was going to do for the guy. But I guess he was contractually obligated to make that first book a certain page count, and they were short 25 pages. I was the most green, which meant I had no other work in sight. So he gave me a call one day, just was like, Ed, do you want to do a lot of pages in a ridiculously short amount of time? And I said, yeah, you know, what's the damage? So I had to do a 24-page story in like 12 days. And comics, like, for those of you who draw comics, you know, a piece of original art is about 11 by 17. And that's just a lot of ground to cover in general. Like, it just takes forever. So, you know, there was maybe 2 weeks of very, very little sleep. I felt my very first anxiety attacks, two of them within that time. I got my first gray hairs at like age 22 or 23. But you know, he powered through it, and I think to a certain extent it was a test in a way, because after he saw that I can meet this ridiculous deadline, and you know, I don't include any of that material here because I'm not happy with it in any way, but he was happy enough with it to give me the opportunity to draw a 150-page graphic novel for him called Macedonia, which when he first kind of pitched it to me, I want to do this comic about Macedonia, and I just thought, cool, like, we're going to do a story about Alexander of Macedon and Aristotle and Diogenes the Cynic. Word. Like, I was thinking, like, I don't even know what kind of reference material to buy for this thing, because Google image search was still semi in its infant stage, and it wasn't reliable for, you know, imagery of really any sort other than pornography. He's like, no, you got it wrong. It's not Alexander the Great. It's a 150-page comic about the geopolitical / religious destabilization of the Balkan region. And I was like, all right, man, you know, sign me up. So there's not really much to say about the project. I used this book and the next one I did with Harp as kind of an opportunity to deprogram myself from the mindset that was imposed upon me at art school, where the school kind of taught comics as a service industry, where, you know, just say yes to everything, and even if you can't do it, make your deadlines, and everything is hunky-dory. So I was still just fighting that idea of just like, no, you know, like that's I don't want to be a hack. And I certainly did my best on this project. It probably should have been a, you know, 300-page comic, but, you know, we were allocated 150 pages, so there are pages that have, you know, 16 or 17 panels per page, just like an avalanche of dialogue with each character. It's weird. After that, you know, the next project he offered was this graphic history of the Beats. And, you know, we had a really, really crazy tight deadline on that project. And just didn't have the time to get everything in the way I wanted. So I had to sort of streamline my process of production. And what I said about that man, Dan Klaus, the Ghost World guy, he did this comic called Like a Velvet Glove Cast in Iron. And every introductory page, it was like a 10-part story. Every introductory panel had this ominous portrait of one of the players in the story. And so I kind of cribbed that idea, you know, sampled. And they call it sampling in hip hop. you know, that motif for the beatnik comic. And, you know, it's probably the most well-known thing I've done, just because it's been printed in a bunch of languages, but I still read reviews, and I just want it to go away and away. This is some of the stuff from the very last strip that I did with Harvey. We did it for DC Comics, the publisher of Superman and Batman, and I received a typewritten script, which was atypical to Harvey Pekar, because if you ever saw the movie, he would draw in kind of like a hieroglyphic, like, stick figure way that was just near indecipherable, and it was like his own language, and got this typewritten script, and we worked in the assembly line method, where, you know, he wrote it, I drew it, but we had a staff letterer apply the dialogue and things, which I've never done before, but they kind of do that so that they can easily change the dialogue for foreign publication and stuff like that. So these are a few examples of my process, where in my sketchbook I would just draw the comic in a real loose way, and then take it to its final stage once that work was approved. And to be honest, I kind of like this sketchbook stuff better. Like looking at it now, all this other stuff seems really overworked. The reason I include this page is because that critic in the first panel is my father. I just like have to sit there and pose for me, and I put him in every single comic that I draw, and because he's a kind of a big fan, in as much as he really likes to brag at the grocery store. So it is embarrassing because I hear about that. And so I want to, you know, if he's going to brag, like, I'm going to put him in the comic and kind of just nudge him a little bit. So in the Macedonia book, I cast him as this creepy date rapist, like, and in the Beatnik book, he is one of Jack Kerouac's lovers. In between Macedonia and the Beatnik book, there was like maybe a whole year of time where, you know, there was nothing but magazine illustration and stuff like that. So what I decided to do was write and draw my own comic, which turned out to be WYSIWYG, and it was meant to be a four installment work of, you know, equal length with two chapters in each volume. And while working on Macedonia, I was sort of deprived of audio material, stuff that would keep me in the drawing chair through the entire drawing process. So I found these podcasts called Off the Hook, and it was this radio show coming out of New York City that describes that sort of ventures deep into hacking culture, and with its political implications, you get to meet actual hackers, and it's a 25-year archive that was on the program, like on their on their server, and I listened to it all while working on Macedonia for 14 months, and I developed this intense love of that culture where I felt a kinship with the hackers who were a part of it. Like the host of the show was also the publisher of this magazine called 2600, which is like the hacker magazine. And so he had this privileged position in the hacker world. He's like, you know, Grand Poobah or whatever. And he would have these hackers on the show 1 week. They would disappear and just not even be a part of it for a couple of weeks. And then you would find out that they're fugitives from the law. And so it was intensely captivating, super cool. And you got to know these people before they became fugitives. And as a cartoonist, I identified with these guys just because they operate in a similar headspace to cartoonists, I feel. It could be just like a false correlation, but you know, hacking and cartooning, it's a problem-solving endeavor, I would say. It's certainly something that you do all by yourself. There's sort of very little reward in terms of being able to share the reward. You know, it's a very just solitary thing, and I identified with these people enough to deem that myself as being the only person who could speak about hacking culture as a cartoonist. So I was able to put out 3 volumes myself, and I kind of have this love me daddy complex where I just want to like blow your mind in a way. Like if you're a friend or something, I'm going to do this comic that you're going to think is awesome. And with all of this information I was taking in about the hacker world, I started to see these names pop up, people who were in that world. So I was always thinking of them specifically as the audience for the comic. And what I started to do was just send them an issue. Whenever I would finish it, I would send a copy to the guy who publishes 2600 magazine. And on boingboing.net, Cory Doctorow, one of the major contributors, is very steeped in the world of technology and its effect on civil liberties. And, you know, he's a friend of Bruce Sterling, who wrote the Hacker Crackdown. So I sent, you know, comics to everybody in that world. In San Francisco, the Bay Area, they have an entire ecosystem of technology entertainment, their own podcasts, blogs, and all this stuff that they just exist in their own world. So I would send this stuff to these people. And at a certain point, they started to blog about it and talk about it on their podcasts and write reviews. And I just started getting crazy amounts of orders. You know, had all these comics in my mom's basement. And it got to a point where this is the third volume, when it came out, I would just send a mass email to everybody who bought the earlier issues. And overnight, just sell hundreds and hundreds of comics. And then it was sort of slowly diminished. So ultimately, I sold thousands of these things. And it was a tremendous incentive to just keep it going because, you know, comics is such an inefficient method of storytelling that, you know, you really have to love what you're doing or else, you know, you're just toast. Like, why not? There's easier ways to make money. And, you know, just work at McDonald's, you probably make more cash. Another way that I supplemented my income through the process, because, you know, in the lulls of my comic book work, you know, you have to you know, pay bills and things. So I would do magazine illustrations. And for anybody here who's interested in doing that sort of thing, which I would recommend, you know, it's sort of low hassle, decent enough pay to a large extent. And what I would suggest is the way it works: you get information from the art director. You get sort of an idea, a plot of what kind of image they want you to draw, and it's usually very, very loose of an idea. And you know, you give them 3 examples to choose from, and what you could do is really crap out 2 of those ideas, and the one that that speaks to you the most, you could really luxuriate over that and tighten it up and do your best that you can to kind of push them in that direction. It works 7 out of 10 times, but it makes the entire process less painful and makes you feel like less of a prostitute or whatever. So this is an example. These are three examples of roughs, as they call them in the business, for an illustration where for a stock market magazine where there were two different schools of thought who were fighting over, is gold a better investment or is silver a better investment? So, you know, super boring, dry subject matter, but the way that I thought that I could alleviate the boredom of it would be to, you know, do you guys know who these characters are? Spy versus Spy for Mad Magazine, right? Probably 90% of you know who these characters are. So you send these roughs to them, and then they approve the one that they like best, and they say, you know, take it to finishes, which is a fancy way for saying, ink the thing and color it. So this is the final illustration that I did for this financial magazine, and they dug it until I got a call the day before it went to press, and they're like, we received word that these are copywritten characters, and we didn't know that. And in the email I sent with the original thing I said, it's like Spy versus Spy, and a lot of editorial cartoonists use Spy versus Spy, so it's a kind of a tradition. We're afraid of getting sued, blah, blah, blah. And it was, you know, they were going to press in under 10 hours. So this image turned into this at the morning. And I was really, I was really spiteful about it. I was really angry because I didn't try to subvert them or anything like that. It was kind of jive, you know. And but they dug the amendment, and, you know, the very next month or whatever, they offered me another illustration assignment. In the financial game, you know, not to get too deep into it, but there's all these weird analogies that these bean counters use, the bull market, the bear market, et cetera, et cetera. So they needed another illustration of the same dimensions for, it's an illustration of the bear market. It needed to draw a bear who was in a train, operating a train, traversing a gorge with silver bars and gold bars in the back of it. So I gave him an illustration. Every change you see here in Pedo Bear's face is an amendment that they consider because, you know, editors and art directors, they just want to put their stamp on it, and the piece is that much better because I put teeth on the Pedo Bear or made his eyes glisten or whatever. So a week before they went to press, I get a call from them. And they're like, Ed. I started getting so nervous. I'm like, oh man, like they don't know who Spy vs. Spy is, but they know what the Pedo Bear is. And I get this call from them, and I'm like, we love that image so much, man, that we want to give you a couple extra $100 and put that image on the cover. So yeah, it was a Christmas issue too, in December 2010. It seemed appropriate. So with all the work that you do in the print game, or probably just in the art world at large, everything you do and put out there, especially in print, you know, thousands of copies just spread out everywhere. You have no control of where they go, you know, how they're distributed or anything like that. So you don't know who's going to get a hold of your work. And a lot of people ask me about, like, you know, how do you break in and how do you do this, how do you do that? And a big part of the game, I would say, is you have to be at the right place at the right time. And it sounds like a daunting phrase and certainly a, you know, cliche and everything. But the cool thing is that I can say is that there are a ton of right places, a ton of right times. And the more that you put your work out there, you just increase your chances of the work getting into the right hands. And, you know, you sort of, you know, that your work paying dividends for you down the road without much of a hassle. And this, in particular, I got a call a couple years ago, just very randomly, from a guy who's like, do you want to draw and design an Adult Swim cartoon? And, you know, I get a lot of offers that are just dubious and you know, a red flag for everybody who's interested in drawing and probably in writing and almost anything creative. If you get an offer that's like speculative, or, you know, it's good exposure, if they say it's good exposure, and to be honest, if they want half of the rights and they're not putting in half the work, like, it's probably not a good idea. So I got all these offers. I'm fairly thick-skinned to that kind of thing. So I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll draw the Dulcimer cartoon for you. Whatever, sure, yeah, so stay in touch. And I just hung up, started to Google this guy, and saw that he's on the level. The way this particular gig, like, bore fruit, as it were, was from before, when I was just sending out packages to every cartoonist I dug. One of the people that I sent my comics to was this guy, Peter Begg, who draws a comic book called Hate, which is really great. And, you know, that was maybe nine years before I got this call from this guy. And Peter Begg, you know, put this guy in touch with me from comics that I sent him just out of high school. It's really weird, like, how you know, you just can't predict how this sort of stuff propagates or whatever. So what I would do is come up with the visuals of the character and give the team, the staff, a 360-degree view of our characters. This is Stack Johnson, and he's a Capricorn. You can see, I made a tremendous effort to put that little loop on the Capricorn sign right in the middle of the back of his whatever. With each character that I designed for the show, each face I had to draw 10 pages worth of facial expressions, mouthing however many syllables this is here, and you know, draw those with different emotions. So this is just an example of the face charts that I had to do, and this is probably like 70% of the characters I designed for the television show. Probably for the first 7 episodes, I would say, out of 10. This show aired very, very late at night last year, and I'm contractually precluded from saying anything bad about it. So. One cool thing that I got to do on the show was, if you remember Ren and Stimpy, like whenever there would be a really cool moment that they would want to freeze and capture, and it would be gross and disgusting, and it would just be separate from the regular animation. So they would have this guy Bill Ray, awesome artist, you know, come up with, you know, show a nerve ending on a tooth and just make it as gross as he possibly could. So I had that opportunity with drawing different pieces of work for each episode of the show that they would cut to. So this is one example. And the rest of these are just a few of my favorites that I did that, you know, they used some, but not all. And for certain segments, the animators, like, we would do all of the thinking work, put all the nuts and bolts together here in America, and we had basically this airplane hangar full of Romanians and way over there to do the actual animation, and I didn't realize that the animators don't necessarily know how to draw. So they would turn in this like substandard animation that was just no good. And so I would illustrate certain sequences like that for them to go by. And that's that for Mogul Wrestling Alliance. The benefit that I got from that was the ability to be able to put to have capital to put my own work together. And what you see right here are it's all the artwork for my WYSIWYG, my final WYSIWYG comic. There's like over 1,000 pages of artwork here that I sort of corralled into a 288-page comic, graphic novel, as they call it these days. And this is the cover for the collection, which is going to debut at the San Diego Comic Con. I'm pretty happy with that and excited to have my first solo graphic novel out there, so we'll see how that does. These are just some pages from it where Kevin is the main character. He's hacking a poem machine, and there's a small strip in there. It kind of takes you through the history of high technology using these analog characters. You know, I'm not comparing WYSIWYG to the quality of Citizen Kane, but in the way that Charles Foster Kane was an analog, or William Randolph Hearst, my main character is an analog for all of the hackers who I read about and listened to, crammed into the vessel of one character, and the story just wrote itself. So it sort of tackles the life experience of all of these guys at once, and because they've lived such interesting lives. There are men who were able to exist as fugitives for years and years and years, and the only reason they got caught was because they allowed themselves to get caught. And because, you know, if you don't speak to your family or anybody you know for like 5 years, it probably gets kind of lonely. And this illustration goes along with a strip in the book where this guy, Kevin Polson, he was able to rig radio call-in shows so that he would win a prize, and he won a Porsche 911. And while working on the book, I started to just receive stories from hackers through email, which I used as much of that material as I could in the book. And I started to receive crazy literature. I got this book called Prisoner's Inventions, where some guy in jail wrote this book about all the different stuff that you could use to make your time in prison easier. Like you take an electrical cord and just sever it from whatever object it was attached to, plug it in, and you could light a cigarette with it, or boil your ramen noodles. So that's that. Oh, you know what? I started to actually meet these people. Doing a piece of historical fiction from a period of time that is only maybe 20 years old, these men are still alive. So I was at a hacker convention, got invited to one, and I see this one guy who I've kind of used some of his life story for my book, and I see him in the elevator with me, and I recognize him, but I'm iceberg, I'll play it cool and not even say what's up or anything, but he saw my name on my badge, and they wrote a piece in Wired magazine about the self-published comic version of WYSIWYG, and there was one panel that was included, and that panel is the part where I called him out, and but it was sort of a shout-out. It was praiseworthy, where I'm like, oh, yeah, I have to include him in some way. And he looked at me, he's like, you have cartoonists. And I'm like, yeah? And he's like, in Wired magazine, you made me look so lame as to think that I couldn't create this thing and I bought it from somebody, blah, blah, blah. So we had this whole fight and everything, but ultimately we became fast friends, and I didn't have to say that next year at that con, he and I did share a bed together. But this panel in particular was pretty cool because he did some time, this guy has strength, and he did some time in prison for his hacking endeavors. And 2 days before he was getting out of jail, he got a hold of some prison stationery, and he was in a federal institution, and in the Fed, you don't get conjugal visits. So he just in legalese speak, he fashioned this legalese kind of document that they would put on the billboard in the common area, that just basically in a long form way just told all the convicts that they were going to be allowed to start receiving conjugal visits, and that was like his coup de grace or something. It was out 2 days, and the whole prison was in a near riot when they found the. So he emailed me that document, and I had to include that in the comic. So now what I'm working on is comic on Boing Boing. Developed a relationship through getting my work reviewed. And they sort of really dug the work, and I was at this place where didn't have much going on, so I just reached out, which is another thing that I would advise anybody who's interested in working in any sort of creative field in print media or whatever. Just don't be afraid. What's the worst? If you reach out, what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody's going to say no. Big deal. Develop a thick skin. You're going to get probably 50 more no's for every yes. And that's just the name of the game. And the guys on Boing Boing said yes, so I had to figure out what's the strip going to be, and it turned into the strip called Brain Rot, which is kind of my examination of just pop culture influences from over the years. Things like Mac Tonight, do you guys even remember that? There was a time when Ronald McDonald was not the face of Mickey D's. It was this moon-headed weirdo that just invaded my nightmares as a child, and I just. The entire time I had to just figure out what kind of comics am I going to do on the site, because I didn't quite expect them to say yes. So just do these little one-page stories that I'm just trying to figure out what I'm doing with the the privileged space that they gave me to use. One of the strips that I did that I received, you know, pretty good propagation, we'll say. A lot of people shared it on Facebook, a lot of people shared it on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera, was this comic I did about the correlation of my two favorite things, rap music and comic books. And I just kind of married the two, just explaining that, yeah, well, you know, there are all these similarities, they, you know, alter egos in the comics and hip-hop and everybody has cool costumes, et cetera, et cetera. So this was a fairly popular strip and inspired me to dig deeper into hip-hop culture in a way, because I always wanted to do a story steeped in this world, but I couldn't figure out the angle. Like, what was I going to do? Was it going to be just a standard, like maybe I could just do a crime comic, just a standard crime comic with b-boys and graffiti as the backdrop, like maybe, you know, just exist in that world. But ultimately, what I'm working on now is the hip-hop family tree, and what I'm doing is just taking my fairly encyclopedic knowledge of hip-hop culture from 79 to about 1990, and even digging deeper and researching more and more for pleasure. I call it a research, but it's really just my excuse to read for pleasure, and the comic is my excuse to allow that to happen so that I don't feel like a slacker, because I don't want to just take all this time and throw away frivolously, you know, reading about Cool Moon D or something like that. So the way the form of the strip is structured is I give you a little piece of the history of hip hop, like maybe a 2-page comic strip, and at the end of the comic, each week on Boing Boing, I give you this ever-growing flow chart that, so whenever I introduce new characters, I put them into the flow chart, and this is my favorite part of it, and I kind of just go through this like an animated GIF in a way to just show how hip-hop culture sort of grows and expands from the earliest days. Like, if you don't exist in this world and you don't have that sort of interest, like, everybody that I'm introducing here to a certain point, you've probably never even heard of, so just next week, we're getting into Rapper's Delight and the very first, you know, rap record. But this is a project that I think I'm going to be going, examining for probably the next couple of years. You know, it's been shared to Good Health. It's getting a good response. Like, you know, actual rappers are trading it online, and it's just helping me gain more and more of an audience. And it seems to, people seem to enjoy it and dig it. So that's where I'm at this point. And I spoke for 52 whole minutes. See, I told you I was going to steal a whole hour of your life. Is there any questions, or should we cut out? Because
we can take a couple questions, and then there's pizza upstairs, and everybody, they can continue to talk upstairs with you.
Cool. Yeah, I'll be upstairs hanging out and everything. Come grab a slice. Does anybody have any questions? Was it thorough?
Bill? Well, I guess just because for the audience here, just did you have any color about, like, you know, negotiations, working with publishers, how, like, any advice for, you know, people trying to, you know, how you just deal with the reality of publishing, you know, contracts, any little bon mots?
Yeah, I wouldn't expect to make $1 million on, you know, a piece of work. To a large extent, if you're a writer or a cartoonist and you're lucky enough to get any kind of advance, you can almost expect, just the way that whole business is structured, you can almost expect that might be the only money you're going to receive for that project. So you have to keep that in mind, and for yourself, you have to ask yourself, like, is this project worthy enough of my time and effort to do all this for free? And to be honest, I feel like to just have that pure of an intention seems to yield fruit in a way, because you know, there are a lot of people out there who are just kind of like doing comics or whatever as a way to option a movie or something like that, and that stuff falls by the wayside. The cream rises to the top, and I can think of 4 million other platitudes to put in place of that. But by and large, what I would say is, if you're working with publishers, you know, like, there are certainly interested in making money, and everything's negotiable. They don't go with the first offer, and certainly, like, I'm very accessible, I do have a lot of experience. If you wanted to share, some of your plans with these people, with other cartoonists, people who you respect and who have a good head for that sort of thing, that would be a huge benefit. Everybody's pretty much approachable. You can find anything on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and ask before you sign anything, just because you might be able to do better. In a lot of ways, with Kickstarter and things like that, if you have that kind of mind frame, it might be better just to publish your own book. It depends what you want out of the process. Anything else?
You mentioned kind of your generation, or being the end of a generation that grew up exposed to like normal X-Men-ish comic books. It seems like maybe like 10 years after you, or like kind of our generation, or like being exposed more in high school to like literary fiction, Jimmy Kerrigan, Fun Home, and like Ghost World. What influence do you think that's going to have on like kind of the next generation of comic book artists?
Yeah, I think we see. I think we're really seeing a lot of that now, and there is that movement towards doing more literary work, and I sort of find that to be not completely unfortunate, but a little bit, because we're relegating, with being academically minded about the whole thing, we're starting to castigate the normal audience, just regular readers who are interested in just checking out a cool comic, and it's becoming a kind of poetry, poetry sort of ecosystem where each cartoonist is just like in a circle jerk battle against other cartoonists to try to out-clever each other, and it doesn't speak to me in any way. Like, with the stuff that I've been doing with Mizzywig and with this Hip Hop Family Tree thing, like, I'm more interested in speaking to other people outside of comics, and the Jimmy Corrigan stuff, the Dan Kyle's work, a lot of people are creating really insular comics for each other inside that already small niche. So in a way, I see it as like self-defeating to a certain extent, because these guys do these comics and then they wonder why like so many people are reading them, and you check them out and it's like I've lived in comic book world my entire life and I can't penetrate this, like, and I feel stupid because it's like, oh, is this over my head? And I'm actually willing to guess that a lot of that stuff isn't, they're just trying to be clever.
I'd say one specific difference is, like Ed was talking about the generation before, you could read comics as a kid, you could just discover them in complete randomness, like, what's this, and when you're talking to comics, you're talking about, it's not, you really can't discover Jimmy Corrigan or Ghost World or Fun Home until you're at least in high school, and your brain processing language is different by the time you're in high school than when you're a kid. It's a big difference in terms of language acquisition, because the one key thing is comics are a language.
Right. Yeah. My man, Bill Boyshell, Copacetic Comics, Bill Boyshell, man, it's a good place. You should check it out. Anything else? Nick?
I know that Hip Hop Family Tree is going to be a really big project for you. Are you, I don't know if worried is the right word, but as it goes, every artist's style changes as they continue to work. Have you thought about how once you reach the end of it, your style may have changed from how it is at the beginning?
It's quite on my mind, but I think an interesting part of it, because we're going to span maybe 30 years of time, and if the art style evolves, it could work in tandem with the evolution of the music. So that's the excuse that I give myself to just not worry about that. And I try to keep, you got to keep positive minded when you do this work. It's it's a solitary process. Each page takes a long time to do, and you have to keep yourself in a good mind frame to get through these big projects. What I really should start to figure out is how I can do like a 5-page comic and just be done with this. WYSIWYG took 5 years of off and on work, and this comic, who knows how long it's going to take? I can't even think about it, and I'm so juiced up about it anyhow. So I'm very excited about it. So I just have to keep doing my thing. I get a weekly reward by putting it on Boing Boing and getting feedback from people. And there was a span of 7 or 8 weeks where I'm like, ooh, this Chuck D tweeted my comic, word. So there's all these little benefits that I just kind of focus on those. Like the big picture, it exists, but it's down the road. Like leaving here today, I can get hit by a bus and that's the Hip Hop Family Tree. I'm sure you're okay. trying to get some pizza, guys?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice.